This show proudly sponsored by Real American Freestyle Wrestling. Hi, everyone. I'm Brian Kilmeade. If you want something fun and easy to search for homes and apartments, then you should be using the Redfin app. Whether I'm searching for my next place, if I want to buy, if I want to rent, or if I just want to scroll through and see some dream homes, like, for example, something on the beach or at least a walk to the beach, a big house, second, maybe a third floor, I use the Redfin app. Redfin makes it fun to search all the homes for sale and apartments for rent in your neighborhood. You can filter for price, for beds, for baths, square footage, and so much more. So if you find a place you love, Redfin makes it easy to go see it in person. Just schedule a tour right from the app. Plus, if you're looking to sell, Redfin agents know how to get you the best price possible for your home. That's because they close twice as many deals as other agents. And with a listing fee as low as 1%, Redfin's fees are half of what others often charge, which means you'll have more money to put towards your next home. So whether you're looking to buy, you're looking to rent, you're looking to sell, Redfin's got you covered. Download the Redfin app to get started.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Yes. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here on this Tuesday. Bottom of the hour, we talk border, Lieutenant Colonel Alan West, and we talk about the sleeper cells that we know are here. We basically were told that, and Iranians are probably at the base of it. That's my worry. There was over 1,500 that came in, 760 are allowed to stay, let alone the gotaways. And Jamie Metzl's in studio, former NSC and State Department staffer under President Clinton, Senate Foreign Relations staffer under President Biden, former UN official and author of Super Convergence. But we have a lot going on as the President of the United States made some news as he boarded Marine One to Air Force One to head over to NATO. He was upset there was a breach of a ceasefire. Things have since settled down. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
If the Senate does its job, not if, but when, I believe they will. I believe Leader Thune has his steady hand at the wheel. I think we can get this job done. I remain very optimistic that we will.
They have to. They were talking about the big, beautiful bill. That was the speaker on Fox and Friends 1 hour ago. You'll stay until it's done. Those are the words of Senator Thune as they try and get the GOP to agree on this spending and tax reduction package. It's under the radar, but I think the negotiations are pretty intense. We'll bring you the latest.
Number two.
The conclusions I've come to, they are the conclusions of Israeli historians like Amos Goldberg, echoing the words of an Israeli prime minister, Ehud Olmert, who said just recently, what we are doing in Gaza is a war of devastation.
That is the embarrassment. Socialist, radical, Zohran Mamdani. New York City's mayor race is much bigger than one city and one primary as a radical socialist moves ahead of disgraced Andrew Cuomo, who might be the Dems' best hope. I know. But are Sliwa and Adams a better choice, who both have a legitimate shot to win in November?
Number one.
I got to get Israel to calm down now.
That simply said, ceasefire brokered by Trump. Iran and Israel agree to stop bombing, but then Iran breached it by bombing. An amazing milestone, but will it all hold? We're going to explain how we got here. And just to update you, President Trump then came out and said, hey, Israel, don't respond, but the jets were already in the air. So he called Prime Minister Netanyahu, and Netanyahu turned them around. And then the president boarded Air Force One and is on his way. Jamie Metzl, first off, you wrote this column as a Democrat and said, I voted for Harris, but I'm glad President Trump is president right now because you do not believe that Harris would have made the decision to send the B-2 bombers to bomb out the nuclear program of Iran. And since that time, we now have a ceasefire to discuss. Right. So backtrack for a second. Your feeling in writing that column, why did you feel you compelled to write that?
Well, I just felt that as a patriotic American first and a Democrat second, my mission, and hopefully all of our mission, is to say whoever's president, we should say if they do good things, praise them for doing good things. If they do bad things, critique them for doing bad things. And President Trump, I feel, took a bold and courageous decision when nobody would have had all of the information. We didn't know how things were going to play out. There was a window of opportunity when the United States could take a bold and decisive step to push back Iran's nuclear program. And he took it in a way that I felt that Kamala Harris, who I voted for, wouldn't have been able to do so, both of, for personal reasons, as well as because she, as we saw in the campaign, was trying to balance the crazy left of the Democratic Party and centrists like me. And we saw her going back and forth. I think that's what that would have paralyzed her in this critical moment in this particular context.
October 7th didn't happen. One of the most horrific days in Israel's history, the Jewish community's history. Only thing that was worse than that was obviously World War II and the concentration camps. But since that time, Israel has reversed their fortunes in such a dramatic way. Can you possibly put that in context?
It's incredible. So certainly for many, many years before October 7th, the fear in Israel and in the United States was that Iran had built up this axis of resistance with Hezbollah, Hamas, the Houthis basically controlling Syria, controlling Yemen, and having this nuclear program, that we needed to be extremely careful in our responses. And then there was the shock of October 7th, which was like Pearl Harbor in the United States. And Israel realized that just sitting back and trying to be cautious and strategic was actually the least safe thing that you could do, that they needed to be much more aggressive, that they needed to bring the fight to the entity that was trying to kill them. And as I said on October 8th in my on my Twitter X account, that the Hamas is a tentacle, Hezbollah is a tentacle, Iran is the octopus. The only way to address the issue of these proxies was to address the issue of Iran.
So that's what bothers me about the ceasefire, and I support it like you do, and I think it's an interim step, but it's interim.
It's absolutely so.
Because the thing is, if they're allowed to get free of their sanctions, the money's going to Hezbollah, Hamas, and the Houthis.
Yep.
It might be harder to pick it out, but that's what's going to happen. So that makes me think, I know we're into a regime change, but as long as those crazy mullahs are in charge of a country, are we just postponing the next attack?
We are postponing the next something. And the question for the United States, for Israel, is what would happen if we just continued this low-level state of conflict indefinitely? And I don't think that that would have been to our benefit over time. So Iran's capabilities have been significantly degraded. Their nuclear program has been pushed back some, but not pushed back forever. And that's why we're going to need to maintain maximum pressure. We're going to see what happens with the negotiations in the context of the ceasefire. Mm. But one thing that we can be sure is that the Iranian regime is going to do everything possible to reconstitute every aspect of its power. And that certainly means on missiles. They're for sure going to try to build nuclear capabilities if they can get away with it. For sure, there's going to be a horrific crackdown on the brave people of Iran. And that needs to be a priority insofar as we can to try to staunch that and to protect the Iranian people. But we are not out of the woods yet. This is just the beginning. And that raises the question, why not go for regime change? And the issue is it's impossible to do that from the air. I mean, there's been a lot of signaling with blowing up the door of Evin prison, blowing up.
I love it.
Yeah, which is great. And the headquarters of the besieged and others. But that on its own isn't going to bring regime change. And so I think that that the United States, Israel wisely recognize that if we kept this low-level conflict going forever, we might not be able to have achieved that much more that we can achieve
now. And by
the
way, Israel evidently is exhausted. Their Air Force is exhausted. So they needed a break. And I saw yesterday before the ceasefire announcement that the Wall Street Journal was saying that Netanyahu says we basically accomplished our goals. Yep. We're very close to finishing.
Yeah.
So it was not that big of a leap for them to come down, correct?
Yeah, well, so take my feeling is take the win now. Like if you stop now, are there things more that could have been done? Absolutely, yes. But there was also a risk of going on for another month.
I hear you.
And so I think that's why I think this is for now. I mean, you never know what the future holds. For now, this was a pretty big win for both Israel and the United States.
But I used to think when it came to Israel and things like this, there was a lot of Democrat-Republican crossover. There, outside Senator Fetterman, there's almost none. And you have a guy like Julian Epstein came out for it, and other people, like commentators on CNN, who are Biden officials, have said kind of that was a very impressive military operation, but far from praise. Should we just get used to that? Is that the way with the climate we're in right now?
You know, on both sides of this, we have become tribalists to our own detriment. I mean, there are people like me, and that's how we got to know each other. Where I was in the early days of COVID-19, I was saying, hey, I'm looking at the evidence. It's telling me a story that's different from what I'm hearing from Fauci and more like what I'm hearing from President Trump. And so it's not like I was probably more partial to Fauci than President
Trump.
Who
you know.
Yeah, for sure. But I said, if President Trump is saying something that makes sense, why would I oppose it just because I'm a Democrat? And so I just think that we Americans have to be able to look at things and say, hey, that doesn't sound right. When we look at people, whether it's in the New York mayoral election or on campuses calling to globalize the Intifada, we can say, hey, that's not right. As an American, and when we see people attacking the Capitol of our own country on January 6th, we Democrats and Republicans alike can look at it and say, hey, that doesn't feel right to me.
Absolutely. So here is J.D. Vance yesterday on the reprisals that were expected from Iran. We didn't know how they were going to hit back. We're worried about sleeper cells. Right now we're worried about them, but not as much, perhaps. Here's what he said yesterday, and to put it into context, cut 8.
Well, as the president said, they actually gave us some warning here. And we think they gave us some warning because they didn't want to kill Americans and they didn't want to escalate. There's definitely some symbolism to this, Brett. If you look at the Iranian attack, it was 14 missiles that they telegraphed ahead of time. We dropped 14 bunker buster bombs. As the president told me earlier, our missiles, our bombs were a little bit bigger than their bombs. Our bombs actually accomplished the goal of eliminating their nuclear program.
So we found out, too, the Washington Post says the Ayatollah sent instructions that the strikes were to be contained to avoid an all-out war with the U.S., according to officials who are unauthorized to speak publicly about the country's plans. So what does that tell you if that radical 86-year-old said, I don't want a major war? So if he was fatalistic and wanted just to be a martyr, whatever happens, happens. He wanted to make sure this was, I save face to a degree, but I'm not going to hit anything.
No, this was crying uncle. I mean, it would have been terrible for Iran had these bombs actually hit something. They were perfectly telegraphed, which is why the United States had advanced
in Qatar,
warning.
Yeah.
And so these guys, they are certainly chastened right now, but their strategy is to live to fight another day. And we just need to be wise to that and keep the policy of maximum pressure, but with a special eye on Russia and China, because Russia and China are going to be doing everything possible to support Iran. And this really is an axis. When President Bush talked about the axis of evil,
right.
A lot of us scratched our heads because at that point, the tentacles weren't interconnected. Now they are. And I know you've been a big advocate of supporting the just struggle of the people of Ukraine. But this struggle against Iran is connected to the struggle of the people of Ukraine against Russia. If we fully disaggregate that, that's going to be risked.
So everybody. Let's talk about that when we get back.
Yep.
Jamie Metzl's here. He came out and just spoke up in praise of President Trump in this case for what's happening with Iran. So don't move. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Both sides, all opinions. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I'm Janice Dean. Join me every Sunday as I focus on stories of hope and people who are truly rays of sunshine in their community and across the world.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com.
A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Our party has been often wrong, and they were pushing for a ceasefire last year. And now Israel pushed through that and has broken Hamas and Hezbollah as well now, too. And now here it is right now. Israel has air supremacy over Iraq right now. And now here's where where Iran is right now. Their capabilities are severely limited.
And that was Senator Fetterman yesterday, just speaking honestly to people in the hall, saying, why, Democrats, you got to pick your spots, essentially what Jamie Metzl's been saying, which he put in his column to say, I back President Trump on this, even though I voted for Vice President Harris for president. But, Jamie, when we left, you were talking about how this all relates to Russia and Ukraine, a big backer of Ukraine. Yep. I think that Zelensky's one of the finest leaders in the world.
Yep.
And I'm in awe of the way they fight. There was an assassination attempt on him, almost got there by a Polish sniper.
Right.
who was commissioned by Russia. So having said that, how is this related?
So the Iranians and the Russians are deeply interconnected. The Iranians have been weapon suppliers to the Russians. The Russians have been working to support the Iranian regime. And so there's every reason to believe that Russia is going to invest in its relationship to Iran because Russia is isolated. And so now that there is a ceasefire, after a little while of taking a step back to see where things play out, we can be certain that Russia and China are going to be doing everything in their power to support the Iranians. And just like the Iranians and the Chinese have been supporting the Russians in Ukraine, the Russians and the Chinese are going to be supporting the Iranians. And so for those of us who believe that this ceasefire is an important step, we need to make sure that we are highly vigilant because there are going to be a lot of pressures and supports for Iran clawing its way back.
I laugh at their mediation efforts. But Putin yesterday condemned the strikes on Iran, but stopped short of offering any concrete support. I think part of it is he doesn't have any. I mean, he's begging Yemeni fighters and North Koreans to fight for him, emptying up prisons. He's got literally cannibals on the front line. So, and he lost 80,000 people between November and today, but he's not desperate enough to stop.
He's not.
Why?
Well, because we need to keep putting maximum pressure on Putin. If we told Putin, as I believe that we should, is that we are 100% behind the Ukrainians and we're going to keep supporting them. We have learned the lessons from Vietnam and Iraq and Afghanistan. The Ukrainians are willing to fight this fight on our behalf. And if our message to the Russians is you are not going to win, we are going to support the Ukrainians, whatever it takes, we're going to do it smart and we're going to give them things that we think will be beneficial to them. That's a much stronger statement to the Russians.
But where to get Joe Biden? He said that thing directly.
Yeah.
And by the way, slow walking weapons, we both know over that.
Yes.
That's a problem.
Yeah. So could we have done more in the Biden administration? Yes. If in the early days of Iraq, of the Ukraine crisis, we had said, look, you Russians, you have invaded Ukraine. We are going to support Ukraine. And yes, we don't want a nuclear war, but we're going to allow the Ukrainians to fully defend themselves. And that means we're going to give them long-range artillery and say, use it to not to attack civilian targets, but to attack Russian military targets inside of Russia. I think that could have had a profound effect. And I think the signaling that we are giving under the current administration, you talked about me being supportive of President Trump in certain areas. This is where I'm a critic. If we keep giving this positive reinforcement to Putin and saying, hey, we're going to balance the interests of Putin and the Ukrainians, that is encouragement for the Russians. We should be working in support of the Ukrainians because this is all ultimately one fight. The fight to defend Ukraine, the fight to defend Israel, the fight to defend Taiwan. This is all one fight. If we lose on any one front, we're vulnerable everywhere.
I hear you. But I thought that was a great message with the bombing to everybody that we can take lethal action that they weren't expecting and execute it. Lastly, we have to agree on this. We have to expand our military industrial base massively because now we want our allies to build up their defense. They want to buy from us.
Yes.
But we say we don't even have enough. Do you know that Zelensky is asking for Patriots? So I said, guys, why don't you even Patriots? What's wrong about that? They go, we don't have them.
Yes.
You know,
so absolutely.
We have to worry about our guys. That's the problem.
Absolutely. So the world needs, and unfortunately, needs to remilitarize. And the United States, we need to develop our capacity to develop munitions. Europe is starting to recognize that we can. But not only we can make money, the world need we can, but the world needs to be defended by people who share values, making clear that we will fight if necessary to defend our values. When they see weakness, and this weakness has been projected by all parties over the years, that creates opportunities, and we need to prevent that.
Absolutely. Jamie Metzl came out and said, hey, Mr. President, I can support you on this, and that was the bombing that took place over the weekend and the ceasefire. Let's see what the next step is. Jamie Metzl, thanks so much.
My great pleasure, Brian.
All right. When we come back, Lieutenant Colonel Alan West on what came through the border and what Texas can do about it. Don't move. You listen to Brian Kilmeade Show.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
There was a report, you know, over 1,500 Iranian nationals that have entered the country illegally over the last several years. Do we know out of those over 1,500, how many of those have been convicted of a crime?
Yeah, I don't have the number of the conviction, but it's well over 1,000 have entered. Yes, I don't know if it's quite up to 1,500, but yes, it's well over 1,000 have entered our country. And I can tell you we are on high alert and everyone is looking at that very closely.
At the G7, President was told by intelligence operatives amongst our allies, the European, the economic leaders, that sleeper cells are a very real threat in the U.S., with the Iranian situation. That was prior to the bombing, but everybody thought was imminent, by the way. And that's when Macron came out and said, he's talking about a ceasefire. He goes, I'm talking about much bigger than a ceasefire. And as usual, he does not know what he's talking about. Lieutenant Colonel Alan West joins us now, Dallas County Republican Party Chair, American Constitutional Rights Union Executive Director. And he joins us from Texas. Colonel, your reaction... Your reaction to what Pam Bondi said yesterday in sworn testimony, over 1,000 Iranians are here.
Well, this has always been a great concern for us, and Tom Homan's been talking about it. You've been talking about it. Many others have been talking about it, is that when you open up your borders, not just about the criminal illegal immigrant threat that we know that we have here in the United States of America, when you start throwing out numbers of a million, 1.5 million, 2 million gotaways, people we don't know who they are, where they are, those are the ones that don't want to be detected. And when we know that there is a definitive number of Iranian special interest aliens that came across our border and who were released by the Biden administration, this is a national security threat for the United States of America. And that's where we find ourselves now, on alert for what could potentially happen here with these terrorist cells that could take action against the American people and our interests right here in the homeland.
So here is what Senator Lindsey, as we move, and that's the reason, because we took out their nuclear sites, the Iranian nuclear sites. How relieved were you that we took action?
I'm incredibly relieved. I mean, I was a freshman at the University of Tennessee in 1979 when the whole hostage crisis happened. So it's been 46 years. And having been deployed to Iraq and also Afghanistan, the explosive force penetrators that caused incredible harm and damage, maiming many of our soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, killing a lot of them as well. But think about it. October the 23rd of 1983, in the Beirut barracks bombing, 234 Marines, sailors, and a soldier lost their lives. That was the biggest terrorist attack against the United States of America before 9/11. That was Hezbollah, which is a proxy army of Iran. So we've been dealing with Iran for 46 years, and the only person that had previously taken any action was Ronald Reagan in 1988 with Operation Praying Mantis when they tried to seal off the Straits of Hormuz and one of our warships was struck by a sea mine. They only understand strength and might, and we had to take away that capability capacity because you have to take earnestly to heart when people say death to your country and death to your ally and death to freedom in Western democratic states, you got to take them serious.
Here's what J.D. Vance, the vice president, said yesterday when the ceasefire was announced and what the objective was. Cut 13.
And this is, again, what we destroyed is their ability to enrich uranium. If they have 60% enriched uranium, but they don't have the ability to enrich it to 90%, and further, they don't have the ability to convert that to a nuclear weapon, that is mission success. That is the obliteration of their nuclear program, which is why the president, I think, rightly is using that term.
I just love it. I don't trust the negotiations ever to yield anything. The JCPOA was an embarrassment put forth by people who fully didn't understand the region or its philosophy I could not understand. And John Kerry and Barack Obama looked at us as the problem. And Iran is misunderstood, which was insane. And now Iran proving again what everybody knows about the Middle East is that they only understands force and muscle. That's it.
Yeah, and it was George Santayana, a Spanish political philosopher, who once said, those who fail to learn from history are doomed to repeat it. This is 1938. Whenever Chamberlain goes over and sits down and meets with Adolf Hitler in the Munich Accords, and he comes back and says, I have a signed document from Herr Hitler saying that there'll be peace in our times, because we said, yeah, you can have the Sudeten land. And Hitler said, okay, I have no further interest. Well, guess what? Within a year, he overran Czechoslovakia, and then he overran Poland, and that was the start of World War II. How many tens of millions died?
So, Colonel, these people that come out, and some of them are Republicans, and say, if you want to support strikes on Iran, nuclear program, you're a warmonger neocon. They you don't understand. We want peace. We're tired of the Middle East strife and wars. What do you say to those people?
You know, I say, look at me. I am not a warmonger neocon. I've been on the ground. I have been on the receiving end of Iranian aggression by way of terrorist proxies and things of that nature. I take to heart my enemies, and taking away a capability and capacity for them to do greater harm. I wish that someone had done something against Adolf Hitler back in 1938 instead of what we saw happen. So I just don't understand how people don't realize that peace through strength means that sometimes you have to take a stand. And remember the great Latin saying, si vis pacem, parabellum. If you want peace, you know, you have to prepare for war. And this is exactly what we have to do. It's about being a deterrent and taking action, limited action. Mm-hmm. And that's what President Trump did.
Right. You got to not only have the strength, you got to be sure you're willing to use it. And I think Iran got the message, I hope. So I'm all for this interim.
It's not just Iran. It's not just Iran, Brian. It's Russia. It's China. It's North Korea. It's Islamic jihadists and terrorists. And hopefully even the transnational Mexican cartels got the message.
Yeah, I hope so, too. And I think that we are destroying their business by shutting down the border in a way I didn't think was possible. But to stay with this for a second, I'm for the interim step of ceasefire. I also believe that Israel is getting exhausted. And I saw that Netanyahu yesterday morning came out and said, we are very close to achieving all of our objectives. That was, to me, I'm okay to stop now. So, but Lindsey Graham had a great question. I understand ceasefire is a step, but it can't be the last step. Cut 21.
They've been severely degraded. Their nuclear ambitions have been set back in a very large, dramatic way between Israel and the United States. But do they still desire a nuclear weapon? Do they still want to kill all the Jews and wipe Israel off the map, attack Saudi Arabia and purify Islam and come after us? Do they still want to be the largest state sponsor of terrorism on the planet? A ceasefire that will lead to peace is a wonderful thing. And the only reason we're talking about ceasefire is because of Donald J. Trump.
So that's what bothers me. I don't want people to forget what their objective is, and we don't want to be back here in 18 months. And if they start releasing the sanctions, Iranian people aren't going to get better roads and soccer fields. The Hezbollah and Hamas are going to get new funding unless something changes, unless they could be shown that this is the only your regime will be destroyed next time.
Yeah, I think that what you see happening is, you know, the four elements of national power, the dime theory, diplomatic, informational, military, and economic. We have just used the military element of our national power. But let's continue to use the economic element of our national power to continue to put that pressure on the Iranian regime. And one of the things I was very pleased to read about was that the Israelis took out the command and control center for the Iranian military organization that's responsible for putting down resistance. So without a doubt, there is a Iranian resistance that is on the ground. And maybe now we have set the conditions for them to take a more stronger and positive action to do what is necessary in Iran.
Exactly. We don't want a nation built. But if we could open up the prison where the political prisoners are, I'm okay with that. And I love that. I love that Israel did that. I just love it. But lastly, I don't like to bring up New York stories with you because you couldn't be more anti-New York. But there's a story going on in New York with this mayoral race that I think the country's got to pay attention to. We just got a socialist radical as mayor of Chicago.
Yeah.
But we have a guy named Zohran Mamdani, who's 33 years old, with no real job outside assemblyman and no resume. This guy is an anti-Semitic, anti-Israel, radical socialist who wants to give away free food to any working class person. And that means takes over supermarkets, city-run supermarkets. And the other thing is, he is all for globalize the infantata. He has no problem with that. So he sat down with Stephen Colbert and tried to homogenize his image because he's in a basic dead heat to get the Democratic nomination with the disgraced Governor Cuomo. Cut 35.
Anti-Semitism is not simply something that we should talk about. It's something that we have to tackle. We have to make clear there's no room for it in this city, in this country, in this world.
And no justification for violence of any kind?
No, there is no room for violence in this city, in this country, in this world. I know there are many New Yorkers with whom I have a disagreement about the Israeli government's policies. And also, there are many who understand that that's a disagreement still rooted in shared humanity. Because the conclusions I've come to, they are the conclusions of Israeli historians like Amos Goldberg. They are echoing the words of an Israeli prime minister, Ehud Olmert, who said just recently, what we are doing in Gaza is a war of devastation. It is cruel. It is indiscriminate. It is limitless. It is criminal killing of civilians.
He went on to say this, cut 36.
To me, ultimately, what I hear in so many is a desperate desire for equality and equal rights in standing up for Palestinian human rights. And I think what's difficult also is that the very word has been used by the Holocaust Museum when translating the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising into Arabic, because it's a word that means struggle.
So he said that was his defending supporting the word, the phrase globalize the infantata. Do you believe that? It ultimately is just a desperate desire for equality, really?
No, I don't believe him one bit. And he's just a slick-tongued Islamic jihadist. And I'm very concerned about what could happen in New York City, just the same as we see Sadiq Khan as the mayor of London. Look, we shouldn't have this ranked choice voting. Ranked choice voting is the left's new way to undermine our democratic process in elections, and that's what they're using there in New York City. And we cannot afford to have a militant, radical socialist and Islamic jihadist, which is what this gentleman is, to be in control of the largest city, the most well-known city in the United States of America. So I just pray and hope that the people there in New York City will go to the polls and vote against this individual and not allow him to have that foothold.
But the fact that he's close is scary. Listen to this.
It's beyond scary.
How about this on defund the police? Cut 37.
When we talk about defund the NYPD, the entirety of the push is defund the NYPD and refund all of these different social services and things that actually create safety.
Exactly. The NYPD doesn't create safety.
Yeah. Yeah, but see, that's the mantra of the left. I mean, it's just the same as all of these folks out there that want criminal, illegal immigrants running rampantly across our country. You know, someone should ask him, should we have people that can go on subways and set women afire? I mean, if you don't have the NYPD, what do you have? Someone that's going to come down and talk to them about their feelings and their emotions? Is that what he considers safety and security? So this is a very precarious time for New York City. I got to tell you, if that guy becomes the mayor of New York City, Colonel Allen West will never come through New York City ever again.
By the way, they want to raise taxes on the wealthy, which, by the way, have left this state more in greater numbers than even California. And lastly, this is what he said in December of 2024. Cut 38.
Grocery prices are out of control. The cost of eggs and milk has skyrocketed. Some stores are even using dynamic pricing, jacking up the cost over the course of a day, depending on what they can get away with. It doesn't need to be this way. I'm Zahran Mamdani, and as mayor, I will create a network of city-owned grocery stores. It's like a public option for produce. We will redirect city funds from corporate supermarkets to city-owned grocery stores.
Do you believe this? John Cassavetes says, I'm giving up Christie's. If you're going to give away food, I'm going to go out of business, so I'm just going to get rid of all my supermarkets.
Hey, when was the last time we heard that? I think it was a place called the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
You know, government-run, you know, grocery and food stores. And what happened there? I remember as a young lieutenant going over to East Berlin, and I saw the empty shelves. That's what this guy is proposing in the greatest city in the world, which is New York City, the home of the New York Yankees. I don't think that's what we want to have in our country. I don't think that's what New Yorkers want. And I I pray that they reject him today.
I do, too. I worry that it's close. Colonel Allen West, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure. And I'll see you in August down here in Dallas, Texas, brother.
August 23rd. We've got a huge venue. I hope to see you up there. I'm going to bring you on stage, Colonel.
Oh, I'll be ready. I'll even take a shower for you.
How about this, Colonel? I got this. I don't know if you know this, but with Teddy and Booker T, We bring one scene in the story to life, and I believe that you would pass the audition for Booker T.
You think so? I'll do my best.
Lieutenant Colonel Alan West, thanks so much. Back in a moment.
Increasing your intelligence quotient.
What the hell did you just say?
It's Brian Kilmeade. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, we are back. I've got a few minutes here. Be able to get some calls if I can. 1-866-408-7669. But how often do I talk about entertainment, Alice, when I'm not on the air?
All the time. It's your true passion.
About the movies, director's cuts. What else do I talk about?
Who's dating who?
Who's dating who?
Who looks best without a shirt on?
Who could break up?
Yes,
who doesn't
too.
Have a shirt on? Tattoos? Well, Brad Pitt, who people say is the most attractive male around, but I don't know, not aging great, if you ask me. Do you think he's aging great?
It depends on the shot. I will say in the clip we're about to play, he was on Armchair Experts with Dax Shepard. He does look pretty good.
Was that different from his normal podcast, Dax Shepard? Didn't he?
No, that's his normal podcast.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Okay, very popular podcast. Here he is talking about, I guess, AA.
I was in pretty, I was pretty much on my back.
Yeah.
You know, on my knees. And I was really open to, I was trying anything and everyone, anything anyone threw at me. It was a particular difficult time. I needed rebooting. I needed to wake the f*** up in some areas. And it just meant a lot to me. So, yeah, the first is, oh, my God, it's coming around. You know, it's coming around.
Yeah.
It's getting closer. It's going to be yours.
Yeah.
But everyone was so open.
It's contagious, right?
It is. It gives you permission in a way to go, okay, I'm going to step out on this edge and see what happens. And then I just really grew to love it.
So what is he talking about? You mean coming around to me? Is he saying
at the meeting,
he has to speak?
Yeah, when you're at the meeting, from what I understand, you're sitting in a circle and you go around and everyone gives their story and they really open up about why they're there, what they've been through, and just sort of the anxiety about having to speak, but then feeling better after hearing everyone speak. And then it became, a way to help him heal.
Right. He shouldn't have married that. I mean, he had Jennifer Aniston, right?
I mean, that was a mistake. I agree.
And then he leaves Jennifer Aniston for
Angelina Jolie.
And then that works for years. They adopt everyone they can.
They had some children on their own, too. Some biological kids. And they adopted some kids.
Right. And then they have this worst breakup ever.
Terrible divorce.
So, and then he has trouble, but doesn't get the kids, right?
Yeah, from what I read, he does have an estranged relationship with his children.
Right. I mean, all of them.
I believe so, yeah. But I mean, this is a good example for men. You're with the good girl and you go for the crazy one because she's more exciting, and this is where you end up.
But do you think she's crazy?
I think she was crazier. I think she probably leveled out.
Right. So now he's bounced back. He's got a younger woman. I don't know if that's related. The fact that when you stop drinking too much, you get younger women.
I think any man in Hollywood generally dates a younger woman, no?
Why is that? I'm going to look into that. Except for, I know the French president, much older woman, former
but
teacher.
He's not in Hollywood, he's in France.
Oh.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brian Kilmeade. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. I come to you from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan. Heard around the country, around the world. We're getting a lot of attention because our Democratic primary, about to tell you why in detail. Varney and Company will have a simulcast, too. The President of the United States is on Air Force One en route to The Hague. Man, it's going to be an impactful NATO meeting. With the President of the United States, at one point, people were nervous when he showed up because they thought he wasn't committed to the alliance. He's actually just the opposite. He wanted to make sure everyone else is committed. And we'll talk about that. I think really impactful. And this on the heels of this weekend strike at the nuclear facilities of Iran and what's happened since, which brings me to the big three.
Number three.
If the Senate does its job, not if, but when, I believe they will. I believe Leader Thune has his steady hand at the wheel. I think we can get this job done. I remain very optimistic that we will.
That is the speaker on Fox and Friends with me a short time ago. You will stay until you get it done. Those are the words of Senator John Thune as they try and get the GOP to agree on the big, beautiful bill. No Democrats, just Republicans will talk about it.
Number two.
The conclusions I've come to, they are the conclusions of Israeli historians like Amos Goldberg, echoing the words of an Israeli prime minister, Ehud Olmert, who said just recently, what we are doing in Gaza is a war of devastation.
Yeah, Olmert went to prison, and he's just an anti-Netanyahu guy. That is Oren Bamdani, the 33-year-old socialist radical who wants to globalize the infantada. Now he's trying to homogenize his image, and he's in a virtual dead heat with Andrew Cuomo. Why this is bigger than just New York, we'll explain.
Number one.
I got to get Israel to calm down now.
That is Donald Trump 2 hours ago. Talking about the ceasefire that went into place 4 a.m. Eastern time that was breached by the Iranians. And the reprisals were in mid-air when Netanyahu told the fighter jets to turn around on the president's request. And now we are in the middle, we think, of a ceasefire. We'll see if it holds. Just fascinating time. The president of the United States was angry. He cursed on the air. We aired it. And it's simply why, and it was on tape, and we aired it anyway, to just say, look, he's like, I have a ceasefire. Both sides agree to it. It clearly, Iran, it doesn't seem like they did it on purpose, and they didn't kill anyone. It just landed, but I think it was knocked out of the sky. But the Israelis say, oh, I've had it. I'm going to go after them. But then we're trying to calm down. We'll see where it goes. But the ceasefire has just got to be the beginning. There's so many other questions. But the president deserves so much credit for getting us where we're at right now, which leads us to what's going on with Lebanon and Hezbollah, and most importantly, what's going on with Hamas in Gaza. Ahmoud Fayyad Al-Khattab leads Realigned for Palestine, an Atlantic Council project that challenges entrenched narratives in the Israeli-Palestinian discussion and develops a new policy framework for rejuvenated pro-Palestinian advocacy. I'd love to see a new approach. Ahmed, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me. Really appreciate it.
So do you think a ceasefire is the right move?
I think for the time being, it's good to take stock and inventory of what's been done. I do worry about these being tactical victories, tactical achievements, with nothing strategic on the horizon. You know, Iran may still have those stockpiles of enriched uranium. They may still have some of their ballistic missiles that are particularly menacing, not just to the Israeli people, but to the Middle Eastern and Arab people. And certainly we still have the regime relatively intact. And so it remains to be seen as to how what Israel did militarily can be translated into political victories.
Right. Here is what J.D. Vance said. Cut five.
We were actually working on that just as I left the White House to come over here. So that's good news that the president was able to get that across the finish line. I think what it means, Brett, is quite simple. First of all, the president, without, knock on wood, having a single American casualty, obliterated the Iranian nuclear program. We are now in a place where we weren't a week ago. A week ago, Iran was very close to having a nuclear weapon. Now, Iran is incapable of building a nuclear weapon with the equipment they have because we destroyed it. So that's a very, very big thing. Now, what that means, I think, is we have to talk to Iran and, of course, to Israel about what the future holds, because while we have obliterated the Iranian nuclear program, our hope and our expectation is that they're not going to try to rebuild that program.
And the problem is, too, the money floods over to Hamas, makes them more powerful. They suppress the Palestinian people, any hope of any type of representative government. And they continue to fund Hezbollah and the Houthi rebels. And wherever they can, try the best they can to destroy Israel. So in that case, Ahmed, nothing's changed.
Well, that's the concern, right? There will never be a safe and an independent state of Palestine that is demilitarized, that is focused on nation building, that is focused on economic and political prosperity for the Palestinian people, while the Islamic Republic of Iran exists in its current shape and format. They have been meddling in the Palestinian issue for really the entirety of the regime's existence. In the 1990s, during the Oslo peace process, they helped militarize the Second Intifada. They supported Hamas in turning Gaza into a so-called resistance base from which billions of dollars were wasted into thin air. And so, yes, I have immense concern that 21 months into the devastating war following October 7th, we're still really in a stalemate.
Ahmed, now there's talk of talks being reinvigorated with the U.S., Israel, and Hamas. I believe they're going to be Egypt offered, but it looks like it's going to be in Qatar. What have you heard?
Well, it looks like there's a desire to leverage the ceasefire between Israel and Iran right now into an opportunity to end the war in Gaza, and to do so in a way that not only allows for the return of Israeli hostages for the end of the horrendous suffering of the Palestinian civilians in Gaza, the starvation, the death, the killing, the maiming, but also in a way that maybe breaks Hamas's monopoly on power, in a way that maybe introduces the beginning of what could be an alternative to their solitary grip on power. And it looks like the Egyptians, perhaps with Qatari help, after all, the Qataris were involved, allegedly, heavily in brokering the ceasefire between Israel and Iran. So if the totality of those threads come together, there could actually be hope for the Palestinian people in Gaza and certainly for the remaining hostages. The question is, can Hamas be pressured into giving up power in Gaza, even if that happens in phases? That has to be on the table, because a ceasefire that brings us back to where we were before October 7th is not only bad for Israelis, it is disastrous for the Palestinian people.
Ahmed Fahud Al-Khattab joins us now. He is he's leading Realign for Palestine and Atlantic Council Project, wants to take a new approach to this. So tell me, what's your vision? What's your vision that you think is plausible and feasible for Gaza and maybe portions of the West Bank?
Well, certainly the principles that Realign for Palestine deploys and adopts is a wholesale rejection of violence as a political strategy. That has failed the Palestinian people for decades, time and again. Violence is immoral, it's ineffective. Then there's the embrace of multiple truths, multiple realities at once. Palestinian freedom and self-determination and independence can and should happen, but it can also happen in alignment with Israeli and Jewish safety and security. These do not have to be in mutual opposition. There is space and capacity for the realization of both people's aspiration without them being in perpetual opposition. Then there is radical pragmatism, and that is going for what is achievable, going for what is doable, what is actually tangible. The sloganeering, you know, globalize the intifada, from the river to the sea, maximalism, a sloganeering around the armed resistance narrative. Not only are they ineffective, they've pushed away prospective allies and partners. I believe that reimagining peace and coexistence as courageous evolutions is the only pathway forward to actually save what remains of the Palestinian people. And that's not kumbaya. That's not just, oh, let's hold hands and everything can be fine. That's actually pragmatic policy that can get us out of this dark time. And I think we have a unique opportunity with President Trump, who has signaled serious willingness to act as a bridge builder, as a peacemaker. And so the totality of that vision, I think, can inform better advocacy, better activism.
But Ahmed, you sound great. I love it. And that's exactly the type of situation that'll work. But who is behind? Who have you convinced to follow you this way? And is there another leader that you believe that has enough of a following to actually put something into play?
Well, one of the things that Realign for Palestine and my hope and aspirations are focused on is to try to talk to the silent majority. Believe it or not, what sustains me amidst the suffering, amidst the hardship, and I lost 35 of my immediate and extended family in the current war due to Israeli bombardment, and yet I've chosen the path of healing and reconciliation, are the thousands of Palestinians, Arabs, and Muslims that reach out to me and say, thank God someone else is saying what we know is necessary, what we know is what's needed, but we have a hard time saying so publicly. So there is a large contingency of my community in the land and in the diaspora in the United States who are thinking this. The challenge is between the terror regime that we have in Gaza, between the impotent Palestinian Authority that is still nevertheless potentially workable in the West Bank, I'm not really reliant on our leadership. I'm reliant on the next generation of Palestinian peacemakers and nation builders. And that's where I think we have to focus our effort rather than waiting for these old school leaders that have failed our people.
Right.
And
But in practical terms, Haniyeh's dead. The Sinwars are dead. I don't really know too many other Palestinian leaders, but who would go to Qatar and cut a deal to bring an end to the fighting and make sure Hamas was no longer in Gaza? Like, who would be the person? Do you have any idea who that could be?
Well, I think this can happen in phases and stages. I think, unfortunately, there has been no willingness to appreciate that even if for the time being, Hamas in the first phase to get the hostages released, to get the ceasefire going, is going to be in parts of Gaza. There can and should be a vision that is multilateral, that involves the Arab League, that involves the Palestinian Authority, that involves the United States, that involves the youth and the Palestinian and Arab diaspora to actually be part of nation building, to actually set up a transitional council of Arabs and Muslims and Palestinians, who, and especially people from Gaza, who can spearhead those efforts.
Because you will have the world, Ahmed, you will have the world willing to, I mean, from the West and the East, pour money, as long as it's not going to the next terror tunnel, into that area. It could be rebuilt as bad as it is. It could be rebuilt quickly. But people just have to know it's going to the right place to rebuild a society, to create a Palestinian homeland that will be as productive as Jordan or as UAE or anything else in the region. You don't have to say Israel is my best ally, but they clearly can function in a region with Israel. Saudi Arabia can, UAE can, Egypt can, Bahrain can. Oman can, Qatar can. Why can't the Palestinians?
Well, that's where I'm focusing on, in addition to the policy work, I'm focusing on some of the narrative work to try to dispel the myths around, you know, the armed resistance crap, the violence around issues, thorny issues like from the river to the sea, full right of return. Those things have to be addressed, because otherwise what we could face is a scenario in which Gaza is simply reconstructed, rebuilt physically, but it's not, you know, it's like Gaza doesn't just need to be rebuilt. It needs to be reconstituted, rejuvenated, so that it's the pride and joy of the Palestinian people, so that it's a model for effective self-governance, for its overlooking the Mediterranean. It could have connectivity to the Gulf region. It could have an independent economy that's not reliant on the UN and UNRWA and all the aid agencies.
Yep.
So that's where I think some of this narrative work that I am pushing is just as important. And again, I think actually amidst all the rubble and all the death and destruction and sorrow in Gaza, there is actually a realization that we can never, ever again allow a despicable terror Islamist organization to claim that they're going to squander tens of thousands of lives and tens of billions of dollars in the name of resistance, in the name of liberation.
Right. Ahmed, are they even Palestinians? Are Hamas Palestinians? I mean,
they're pawns in the hands of Qatar and the hands of the Islamic Republic of Iran. I mean, it was Iran and the IRGC that weaponized Hamas, that weaponized the Palestinian issue in Gaza, that helped turn Gaza into a terror base. And we're coming up on the 20th anniversary of the withdrawal of Israeli settlements in 2005. I left Gaza as a 15-year-old 1 month before the disengagement, the withdrawal. In 2005, thinking that I was going to be an exchange student in the United States for 1 year and then go back and be part of rejuvenating and building Gaza. And instead, Hamas slowly took over, and I had to seek political asylum here because of their actions. But the Islamic Republic of Iran was an instrumental part in the building of the tunnels.
Ahmed Fawad al-Khattab, thanks so much. I hope everyone listens to you. You seem to make a lot of sense and have a pathway there going forward. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
You got it. Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, we are back. Stuart Varney's coming up in about 20 minutes. But when I get back from this break, I went a little long. I will be able to take some of your calls. You can write me at BrianKilmeade.com, click on comments, and I can get to them, too. Special thanks to everyone who came out and saw us in Dayton, History of Liberty and Left. Next up is going to be, I know it seems like a long time, but it's going to go quick, like summer always does. August 23rd, I'm going to be over in Dallas, Texas. Go to BrianKilmeade.com. The VIPs have already set a record, but the venue is huge, 2,100. So I've never had a venue that big. So let's try to fill it up. We got full rooms, 500 tickets sold already. So hopefully we'll be able to close that gap and we'll have some surprises. It's just a time to get on stage and talk to people about in a historic, inspirational, motivational way. BrianKilmeade.com. You can find out more. Of course, I'm going to be on Special Report a little bit later on tonight. We got One Nation most likely to be live to a degree on Sunday with all this breaking news, all the moving parts around the country and around the globe. Very impactful time. This is not going to be a slow summer, believe me. You'll listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Donald Trump has already spoken. He's on his way to Holland. We'll give you the details in a moment.
Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Whether the story that began in 1979 with the Iranian Revolution, death to America, death to Israel, this implacable foe of the West, whether that story begins to bend, Donald Trump has tried to say to the Middle East, you've been fighting ceaselessly. You know, I'm sick of wars. It's time for everybody to focus on trade and making money. It's classic Donald Trump theme. You know, make trade, not war. That's his basic pitch. And there are a lot of people who want to listen to that. Who agree with him entirely. When I talk to my Emirati friends, they say, we're thinking about artificial intelligence. We don't want to think about wars anymore. So Trump will have a receptive audience, not least in Tehran. The Iranians, as much as anybody, would love to join this modern, intense economy. They have a lot to bring to that economy. Their technology is first rate in many areas, sadly, in the nuclear area. In particular. So I think it's just possible. I don't want to overstate it. I think it's a big danger this morning. But the question you're asking, is it possible that we're entering a different period? Yes, it is possible.
So that is Dave Ignatius, deep thinking Washington Post experienced foreign relations reporter and analyst. So he brings that up. You know what I like about it? If this was, say, 6 years ago, 7 years ago, Donald Trump, with an experience in the area, has come up with an idea that something's fit for the business world but never going to work for these Arab countries. Instead, they're saying, look, we tried the Trump years. It really resulted in the Abraham Accords. We saw 4 years with Joe Biden, lowlighted by the Afghanistan withdrawal, the invasion of Ukraine, unrest in the October 7th massacre. That happened under Joe Biden. So maybe we should be open to a new approach to a chronic problem. He went on to talk about Iran and the people. Cut 28.
When you visit Iran, you discover that the meanest thing you can say about somebody is that they're uncultivated. Iranians are a people of subtle distinction, learning, culture, and they've been embarrassed by the regime that they've had, these old theocrats and mullahs. There were, for a while, movies making fun of mullahs that were very popular in Iran. They clamped down on those. But this is a country that really can't wait to be governed in a more modern way. And let's be honest, the mullahs, led by Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei, have made a mess of the country. Its economy is nowhere near what it should be. Its oil industry has been falling apart. It smuggles and cheats on oil with its neighbor Iraq. It spends so much of its money strutting around in the region, financing its proxies. Iranians are sick of that. So there is ground for change. And I don't mean regime change in the dramatic sense of marching to Tehran. I mean a slow process. I hope that out of this comes real engagement between the United States and Iran. A lot of trade, a lot of Americans going to Iran again. That's what's going to change the country quickly.
Yeah, it's going to be engagement. It's going to be a long time before Americans go to Iran again because too many end up in prisons, end up being hostages and pawns that we hope for someone to get us out. Also, this Evian prison and the other prisons, find a way just to open up those doors. Let these people go out. And a lot of them aren't criminals. They're political heretics who don't like the mullahs and the clerics and what's going on in that country. You just heard it. So Lynn Harrison writes me and says, we know that Trump will never get nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. Let's see if we can generate a grassroots effort to end to do just that by soliciting the public for monies and support. We could call it the Nobel Peace Prize. Brian, let's lead that. Let's lead that march. Here's the thing. President wants the Nobel Peace Prize. He knows that Teddy Roosevelt's got it. He knows that Barack Obama has it. He would want it. And the Abraham Accords should have given somebody the Nobel Peace Prize. Jared Kushner deserves one too. But now this could be really something if this ceasefire holds. Caspian in Colorado. Caspian.
Hey, how you doing today?
Great. What's on your mind?
So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about something. So I have family in Iran. They're actually on Israel's side this whole debate. And they're actually we're all really happy about what Donald Trump did to the Iranian nuclear facility. My dad in Seattle is an immigrant from Iran. He's a big Trump supporter.
Well, how do you feel?
I'm really happy about this. I'm okay. Hoping that this whole regime will be overthrown, and I know it's going to be a slow process, but I'm hoping that the people of Iran can at least, they know that their government has been weakened by this whole, what Trump did, and that there's going to be an uprising, and that this regime that's been oppressing the people since 1979 will be overthrown.
So, Caspian, Let me ask you something. I see these people in the streets, and I watch just the Arab channels, and, you know, CNN has a reporter there. And they seem upset at us in Israel. Are they? I mean, or are they, is there, are they just putting cameras on this, on the people that support the government? The majority don't?
I have a feeling that that's what's going on. Like, they're putting cameras on the people who support the Iranian government, and they're not focusing on the majority that I feel don't, especially my family who is not Muslim. So they're being even more oppressed by this government.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see what happens. I think you agree with me, and maybe your parents do too. It's got to come from Iranians. It can't come from it can't come from people on the outside, the MEK or anything like that. It's got to come from the people inside, because it's got to stick, and you don't want someone to blame. You know, so you go, well, if it wasn't for the Americans, if it wasn't for the Israelis, if it wasn't for the dissidents, well, we would have had a government. No. Make you guys figure it out yourselves. But in the meantime, stop terrorizing the region and the world. Sandra in New Jersey. Hey, Sandra.
Oh, hello, Brian. Brian, I wanted to talk to you about this. This Mandani man that's running.
Zohran Mamdani.
Yes. I learned today that he wants to give a lot of money, like millions, to get the surgeries for minors going on again. He wants to go into the hospitals and find out which hospitals rightfully stop such a practice, and he wants to get that going. And then also he wants to revamp the supermarket change, and certainly John Cassimatidis wouldn't like that. And he even said if this man wins, he's leaving, and so is Bill Ackman, the fund hedge billionaire.
The hedge fund guy, and here's why. Because, you know, just because they have a lot of money, they got money because they didn't waste it. And for people not to appreciate the money that they've acquired and then the way they're reinvesting it in whether it's funds or other opportunities, or they grow businesses or buy into different businesses. Instead, you think they're the problem. Listen to this guy talk about trying to justify the phrase globalize the infantata. Zoran Mamdani on Bulwark, cut 36.
To me, ultimately, what I hear in so many is a desperate desire for equality and equal rights in standing up for Palestinian human rights. And I think what's difficult also is that the very word has been used by the Holocaust Museum when translating the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising into Arabic, because it's a word that means struggle.
So you're equating with the Palestinians going through to what the Jews went through in Nazi Germany. Unbelievable. Globalize the infantata. Thank you very much. Here's what people want: equality. You know what they chant? They want equality. There were catchphrases with that roll right off the tongue. Look it up in the 1960s. I'm sure they're available on various newsreels. Here's more from Mamdani on defunding the police back in 2021. He won't say it this directly anymore, but this is what this guy stands for. Cut 37.
When we talk about defund the NYPD, the entirety of the push is defund the NYPD and refund all of these different social services and things that actually create safety.
You believe this guy? Let's defund the NYPD and create safety with social services. That's the guy you want as mayor? That's the guy up 2 points in the latest poll in New York? Lastly, 2024, December, he's got this genius idea, city-run grocery stores. Cut 38.
Grocery prices are out of control. The cost of eggs and milk has skyrocketed. Some stores are even using dynamic pricing, jacking up the cost over the course of a day, depending on what they can get away with. It doesn't need to be this way. I'm Zahran Mamdani, and as mayor, I will create a network of city-owned grocery stores. It's like a public option for produce. We will redirect city funds from corporate supermarkets to city-owned grocery stores.
Insane, right? Insane. We're going to redirect taxpayer dollars so we could have a grocery store marked below price, below the margin, in order, because they're not looking to turn a profit, I don't know, in order to what, drive the privately run supermarket out of business? And you guys might put them into work in New York City? Chicago Tribune has an editorial really to the people of New York. You don't want what we have. And that's Brandon Johnson, who got there on ranked choice voting, I think. He wasn't the top vote getter in the first round, but he was in the second. And he's got the job. And his approval rating's about 18%, if not 14%, because he sucks. Just everything is race with this guy. Terrible on security and illegal immigration.
Now, the Brian Kilmeade Show joins Fox Business's Varney and Company with Stuart Varney, live on your radio and on Fox Business. Here's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, we are back. Stuart Varney's going to be with us shortly. We'll do a simulcast on FBN. So we got this huge radio network, and he's got this huge TV network, and we're kind of going to combine into one communications behemoth. And at the back end, I'll be going to your phone calls, and I promise to start with Danny because he's calling from Israel. I got to get his perspective on the late bombing that breached the ceasefire by Iran. And when they breached the ceasefire by Iran, Israel's were prepared to answer back, but it stopped midair. Let's listen to Stuart Varney.
That's the latest quote on Bitcoin. It's almost, it is now, boom, 10:51. Time for Kilmeade, and here he is. Brian, first of all, take a look at this clip from President Trump. Now, this is back in 2016, and he's talking back then about America first foreign policy. Watch.
My foreign policy will always put the interests of the American people and American security above all else. Has to be first. Has to be. That will be the foundation of every single decision that I will make. America. Thank you. America first will be the major and overriding theme of my administration.
That was 2016. He hasn't changed. But you know, Brian, Democrats have been saying that Trump's going to start World War III. They don't seem to have a real response to Trump's America first.
They don't. And the thing is, instead of the Democrats not getting on board, the rest of the world is. Do you know what I saw over the weekend? The Houthis evidently were asked, why are you not helping Iran? They say we're the Houthis first. And now we have people running for election on that platform for their country. It's not bad news for us because people think that if you are focused on your country, you don't care about others. No, what you're doing is the people that put you in office want you to represent them, knowing that we have allies and interest overseas. But if you put the focus on them first, that's really giving respect to the voter. And that's what he's always tried to do. I mean, if you just think about it, Joe Biden wants a more traditional foreign policy. It got us Afghanistan. It got us Ukraine. It got us October 7th. And Trump got handed three hand grenades, right? He tried to cover up on one. He's trying to calm the one down in Ukraine. He got a ceasefire in the other. Who knows what's going to happen in Afghanistan? But now we got to find a way to recalibrate the Middle East, because you guess what? There's only one problem in the Middle East right now, and it's not Saudi Arabia and it's not Qatar. It is Iran. You settle that down. And I know those are not perfect democracies. They never will be, nor is it their aspiration. But they want to be progressive economic engines. They have a lot of bright people, well-educated people. They got plenty of financing. And then what the president did in going to visit those Sunni nations, I think, laid the groundwork for Iran to be feel like somewhat surrounded. And one of the big moves was Syria. It took a lot of guts, and I hope it pans out, for the president to recognize Syria. You know what's so good about that, Stuart? They kicked out the Russians, and they kicked out the Iranians. And they're not an enemy of Israel. So another side of Israel is healed somewhat. Worrisome, but still better. And then the other side is actually, get this, the Lebanese are close to running Lebanon, who are not anti-Israel. And Hamas is flat on its back. That's got to be addressed. I think we could have talks in a couple of days. You could do all that and be America first.
Yeah, it's astonishing what he's accomplished in a very short time. You just ran through a whole list of things that have happened in the Mideast. I put it to you that we've reset the dynamics of the Mideast just in the last couple of weeks. It's a different ball game now. You with me?
Stuart, I think what happened is the British did this early, and we might have taken over. The British had more of an imperialistic view. The U.S. just wanted to have influence. I think people are making an understanding. If you have problems, don't blame us. Don't blame the French. You know, Algeria blaming the French. This is you. You need help. You need aid. You want an alliance. We'll do it. But you're really going to have your own problems. Oh, and you have a nuclear weapon? That becomes our problem. We're going to get involved. But if you have uprisings, problem with your government, we're not going to get involved. And this also alleviates us from being the ones to blame for their problems.
I think he's really... I was interested today. He's off to the NATO summit. He's just done the ceasefire in the Mideast. Now he's at the NATO summit. This president is striding across the world. It looks like, I've said this before on the show today, but it looks like he is running the world.
He's supposed to be. And here's what he did. Instead of saying, I'm in NATO, in the beginning, he's like, I'm not sure about this alliance, and everyone's upset, and, oh, he's not really elected, and the Russians put him in office. That's the feeling in 2017. Then all of a sudden, you know who never said that? Stoltenberg and Rutte, who are now running NATO. Because know what he was saying? Be responsible for your own defense. Will you please get to the 2% threshold? Will you understand that America can't watch your back and everything that you do? Stop putting money into your social programs and not into your defense. Why do we have to do it? Now, in the beginning, that was abrupt, and it took a lot of people by surprise, including me. But now, most are paying their 2%. He says, get it up to 5%. Most are pushing back. And even Germany now is saying we might start the draft.
They will. Out of time. Brian, great stuff today. Thank you very much indeed. There will be more Varney after this.
Absolutely. Danny, you're over in Israel. Hey, Danny.
Hi, Brian. How are you doing?
Good. What's on your mind?
Okay, so two comments, Brian. Sorry, there's an ambulance here. So two comments. First, about President Trump today stopping Israel from retaliating. It was an excellent move. However, he should have warned Iran that this is the last time that he stops Israel if they breach the ceasefire again. And unfortunately, he didn't. But let's hope they understood it, Brian. Now, about Mahmoud's analysis on Gaza, I agree in principle, but when he talked about rebuilding Gaza with the new generation, he missed the point that this generation was educated in UNRWA schools. They were educated to kill Jews. They were educated to hate Israel. So first step is to remove UN and UNRWA from Gaza.
I did not know that. UNRWA, by the way, you're talking about the UN organization that we all finance. You're saying that UNRWA goes in there, not only supplies aid to the Hamas, and as much as they can. But you're saying that they also set up the curriculum?
Brian, we found in IDF found in UNRWA schools books of Mein Kampf, Hitler Mein Kampf, translated to Arabic. Books showing how a jihad. Books showing how God is to kill Jews and Israel.
Gotcha.
And it was
well. That's educational for me. I'm going to bring that up to soon to be Ambassador Michael Waltz. Hopefully, we'll address that.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. Brian Kilmeade Show coming to you from Midtown Manhattan, where this big mayoral Democratic Party primary is taking place. This hour, we're going to be joined by Jennifer Say. She is an author, filmmaker, an outstanding business executive, fantastic athlete. And she's going to be with us talking about her brand new projects, the economy, and so much more. And this hour, we're joined by Michael Rubin, Director of Policy Analysis for the Middle East Forum, also a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, teaches classes on terrorism for the FBI, and also on security, politics, and religion, and history for the U.S. and NATO. Michael, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me, Brian.
Michael, first off, are you concerned at all about the sleeper cells? We learned the president was warned by that directly at the G7. That the Iranians have sleeper cells in our country. We see their hundreds came across during the Biden years. What do you hear?
Yes, I'm very, very concerned about it. First, big picture, Brian. Look at how creatively Ukraine attacked into Russia, Israel attacked into Iran. Do we really expect that our adversaries haven't put such plans in place to attack us? The next Pearl Harbor isn't going to come over the horizon. It's going to come from within the United States. But we know already that there have been sleeper cells here. In 2006, there was an astute bartender down in Arkansas who noticed that an Iranian-American member of the Arkansas National Guard was asking way too many questions. He alerted the FBI, and it turned out upon investigation that this person had been a member of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, but lied on their immigration application. We ended up going after him in immigration court. But the fact of the matter is we've seen that. We've seen the Iranians work with Mexican cartels and Azerbaijani mafia. The sleeper cells are here.
Yeah, they are. And it's just amazing why they would surge our border by the hundreds and now get up to 1,500 in 4 years. Do you think they saw the vulnerability there? Because you had an administration who was actually friendly to Iran, begging for a new deal.
Well, yes, they certainly did see the vulnerability there. But Brian, it goes beyond that. Whenever any Iranian-American goes back to Iran to visit family, they get interrogated at the airport. Whether they know it or not, their computers, their phones are sucked dry. What's the likelihood that some of these people have had things on their phones or computers that make them subject to blackmail? And ultimately, that's how espionage works. Some people do it because they're ideologically motivated. Some people do it because they want money. And other people do it for to try to avoid embarrassment. The Iranians are all very sophisticated about this. But Donald Trump is also really smart, Brian, because by talking about this publicly, he's going to create panic among some of these cells. They're going to try to call their handlers. They're going to try to move. And that gives the FBI greater opportunity to try to smoke them out and intercept them.
You're the expert, but Michael, you know it would go a long way to let them know if there's a terror attack here from an Iranian surrogate or a sleeper cell, that is like an attack on our homeland. And you let Mr. Ayatollah hiding in some bunker somewhere outside Tehran, that's like going after us. That's like going after us anywhere, anytime, and we're going to go after them again hard.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you, Brian. The only thing I would expand on that is if a hair of any American's head is harmed anywhere in the world, if you go after diplomats in Bangkok or tourists in Bulgaria, then we are coming after you hard. I mean, the great thing about Donald Trump's attack on the Fordo, Natanz, and Isfahan nuclear power plants, whether you agreed with him or not, is that he has restored American deterrence. Even the Chinese are now recognizing that the Americans are no longer the paper tiger they thought we were. If anyone now or in the future touches America, they have to consider when they do their cost benefit analysis as they plan their terror, their terrorism, that we could come after them much in the same way that Donald Trump destroyed a 20-year project of the Islamic Republic. And remember, for all the Iranians talk about wanting to enrich uranium for their nuclear power station at Bushehr, they haven't put any of their enriched uranium in that nuclear power station. That's a big tell that they've been lying all along.
So, Michael, are you one of the people that said it is worth it to take out these sites prior to the hit, even without the ceasefire that resulted in it?
Yes, I absolutely do think it was wise. Look, Brian, I understand that some people, for constitutional reasons, or perhaps out of animus towards Israel, don't want the United States getting involved. They don't think it will make America great again. But if there's a calculation, if we have a choice, you can show your animosity to Israel, your spite, and stand down because Israel has, according to some narratives, started something they needed the United States to finish. That's one choice. The other question is whether doing that is actually in the security interests of the United States if Iran could reconstitute its program. A quick analogy. When you have a hornet's nest, you have two good options. One is to leave it alone. The other option is to get rid of it. But the worst possible outcome is to stand underneath it, lightly tapping it with a stick. What Donald Trump did was ensure that that wasn't what we ended up having to do with a swarm of hornets around us.
Michael, the way they profile is they only understand strength and a willingness to use it. It's not so much a big, if you are hesitant to attack, they're going to take advantage of you. That's the only thing the Iranians seem to understand, and many other terror groups seem to understand. I want you to hear what Lindsey Graham said. As happy as he is with ceasefire, and I feel the same way, he's got to hear some other things. Cut 22.
Here's my question. The Iranian foreign minister said at 4 o'clock Mideast time they would no longer attack Israel if Israel doesn't attack them. That's not enough for me. What I want him to say tomorrow morning is not only will we not attack Israel in the future, we recognize Israel as a legitimate member of the Mideast, a sovereign nation entitled to live in peace, and we no longer desire... We no longer will try to destroy the state of Israel. We've changed our policy when it comes to Israel.
We're not close to those things, are we?
No, we're not. That worries me. And we shouldn't. I mean, Lindsey Graham is right here. He's seeing the big picture. There's absolutely no historical reason for Iran's enmity toward Israel. And we know that the reason why Iran has its missile and nuclear program was to target Israel. We know this. Because when the father of Iran's missile program was killed in 2011 in Persian in the newspapers, and this wasn't reported in the United States, he said he wanted his epitaph to read, "The man who enabled Israel's destruction." But what worries me more, and I see as an intelligence failure, perhaps on par with that which surrounded Iraq, is we need to know where the enriched uranium is. If we lost track of it, we need to understand how we did that. Because, God forbid, that falls into the wrong hands. That falls into terrorist hands. We can't simply talk about whether Iran can construct a nuclear bomb as we would. The perfect can't be the enemy of the good. If they have the ability to make a dirty bomb, that's dangerous if we don't know where that enriched uranium is.
Just looking through the Middle East right now, the president seems to have made good progress with Qatar. I know they have a nation with two faces. They also have to exist in a very dangerous neighborhood. The UAE, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain has always been good. Jordan and Egypt. Where do you stand with the president's decision to lift sanctions from Syria?
You know, just because you shave your beard and put on a business suit doesn't make you any more al-Qaeda than you were. A reformed al-Qaeda uses a sharp knife, not a blunt knife. But what worries me is this. Al-Jalani is not fully in charge of Syria. He controls about 40% of the country. My colleague at the Middle East Forum, Jonathan Speier, drove across Syria and for more than 100 miles didn't see a single checkpoint of Al-Jalani's forces. We know that when he took over Syria, he had 35,000 to 40,000 men, not enough to run a country. And not all of them were so-called reformers. Now he's had to recruit so many more, many of which aren't anywhere close to reform, I'm worried that he's going to start playing a game of good cop, bad cop, saying, hey, look, I've reformed. Mm-hmm. You can't trust these rogue guys, but with a nod and a wink, he's giving them the green light.
But so, Michael, this is one thing I can say. I love that he's kicking out Russia, and I love that he locked out Iran. That helps.
That absolutely does. But what I worry about, as Iran, as all of Iran's proxy terrorist groups are orphaned, Hezbollah, Hamas, the Iraqi militias have sat in their barracks largely out of fear of what the United States might do. Even the Houthis might be cut off. What I'm worried about is that Turkey or Pakistan might decide to throw these resistance groups a lifeline.
Good point. What do you think it happens to Iraq now? I mean, they have not had a chance to exist without being, as they've got rid of Saddam, thanks to us, without being under the thumb of the Iranians. Do you think Iran releases that grip? Because there's nothing Iran, the Iraqis and Iranians don't get along. I mean, they're just basically, Iran's got the power. They got Shia. They have a Shia population. So they saw a relationship of convenience. But in the Iraqi world, they don't want to have Iran all over their government.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. As you know, I go back and forth to Iraq quite often. Most Americans are locked in their imagery of Iraq from the Iraq War. When I talk to Iraqis, their biggest complaint about Iran is these bastards keep dumping cheap manufactured goods on us and undercutting our economy. It's a completely different discussion. The fact of the matter is, however, Iraqis have always been nationalists. They've always wanted the Americans to balance out the Iranians so they can have space to develop. If Iran is weaker, it means they're not going to want the United States there as much. And that's a good thing, so that they can build and consolidate their own system, their own control.
So you're saying that what is your theory on why they have not done anything, you know, rocketing our bases or tried to even create some unrest? Is it because Iran's come off so weak, they don't want to be part of this? They want to separate themselves from the Iranians?
Absolutely. I mean, and it's not
the militias,
just
the I mean, actually not the government, but the militias, Michael.
I've had long conversations with the Iraqis about this. First of all, the government has slowly been getting stronger. They're able to assert force. The Iraqis are exhausted by war. They want to grow their economy. I mean, more than half the Iraqis were born after the 2003 war. They want to be Dubai. They don't want to be the Islamic Republic of Iran. And as elections are coming up in October in Iraq, basically the politicians are responding to this groundswell, this new attitude from the youthful Iraqi people.
Yeah, I guess there's a little bit of hope there. We took our eye off the Iraq ball. People are fatigued by it. I understand it. But it all could be coming together in a more positive way where they actually have elections and not explosions. And, you know, who knows how this thing is going to end up. And lastly, the President of the United States is going over to NATO, and he's going to be meeting personally in a bigger setting. What should his message be to NATO now about the Russian threat?
He needs to be consistent about the Russian threat. He should say, look, it was important to try diplomacy. Vladimir Putin didn't respond. And what makes Donald Trump different from his predecessors is he does see the forest through the trees. He doesn't get bogged down in process. And he should tell NATO, I'm willing to work with you. The other thing he needs to talk to NATO about, he needs to be consistent. NATO is able to do the 3% of its GDP towards defense, but you can't keep shifting the goalposts, starting to talk about 5 and so forth. That's going to lead the NATO members to sort of walk away, to splinter the coalition, and Russia will take advantage of that.
Yeah, we're not at 5. We're at 3.7 or something like that. We're a third. So the fact is that 22 nations are pending too, and it looks like Germany is starting to realize they have to defend themselves. They're even talking about having a draft in Germany.
Yeah, no, look, absolutely, this is important. The Russian threat is grave and growing. People need to understand the problem with many of these rogue regimes isn't the grievance. It's not anything Ukraine did or did not. It's ideology, and that's much harder to tackle. We've got to stop fooling ourselves that there's some sort of diplomatic magic formula. At the very least, we need to be prepared for the worst possible outcome in the hope that we can avoid it.
Two quick topics. The U.S. can't be blind to China's aggression against India. I have not noticed that. I know they didn't get along. Are they beginning to amp up their anger towards each other?
China is amping up its anger towards India. It's doing what we call salami slicing. Little by little, tackling this. But remember, for all we talk and worry about China, China is the only country in the world that has an army made up of only children. India, every Indian soldier has on average 3 or 4 brothers and sisters. And so for all of China's bluster, there's an open question about whether they really can go into a major war, given that the elites of Beijing and Shanghai don't want to lose their sons.
Wow. I've never thought about that. That's really interesting. And also, you believe even though Erdogan and President Trump have a great relationship, Turkey is a country to keep your eye on. What do you worry about there?
Look, the statistic that most defines Turkey to me comes from Turkey's own interior ministry. Since Recep Tayyip Erdogan came to power, the murder rate of women inside Turkey has increased 1,400%. And that's a result of the sense of impunity that the religious conservatives have. We see that Erdogan is becoming, in effect, a state sponsor of terror. The only difference between him and others is that he has the shield of NATO to hide behind that makes him immune to consequence.
All right. Thanks so much, Michael Rubin. Thanks for bringing us through the trouble spots of this world. He's director of policy analysis for the Middle East Forum. Thank you, Michael. When we come back, we'll take your calls, 1-866-408-7669, and then talk to one of America's great CEOs, Jennifer Say, in just a moment. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show.
You're with Brian Kilmeade. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back. Just a quick note. A lot of people are writing, and I guess, Allison, you should have pointed this out. It's Intifada. I guess I was saying Infatada, which I think is a children's song.
We did have a caller correct that as well.
Oh, really? Okay, so here we go. Intifada. Just know I'm not supporting it. An uprising in Gaza. Or in New York City. Either one of them. That's pretty clear.
We will note that.
If you don't mind. The other thing is, yeah, they do. Well, a lot of people, I've gotten about 5 emails. People say, stop referring to the Palestinians. I mean, I can't
really.
What
do they want you to refer to them as?
I mean, well, for a while, historically, Israelis called themselves Palestinians in the area when the British were occupying Jerusalem, you know, and it, you know, what we now know as Israel. I don't think that I would benefit the radio audience by using anything but Palestinians. I will say this. I don't think Hamas is Palestinians. They're just a thuggish group that's looking to dominate that area and destroy Israel. So that's one thing I'll agree with you. But I don't think I can relabel them on my own to be historically correct because I think it would absolutely throw off the audience. Here is Ambassador Mike Huckabee about what's at stake and what Trump has done with Israel. Cut 6.
Well, I think it is. And it's that way because President Trump has a resolve that they're not used to seeing. They're used to people backing out of what they say and not keeping a promise. This is a president who has made many promises about the Middle East, and he's kept them all. So if Iran thinks that they can violate the ceasefire, if they can go ahead and just keep doing what they've been doing and building a nuclear weapon, they'll find out that with President Trump, he's not playing. For a long time, we've been saying, pray for the peace of Jerusalem. Donald Trump may be the first one to actually help make that happen.
All right, that is Ambassador Mike Huckabee. Donald Trump put this out. Both Israel and Iran wanted to stop the war equally. It was my honor to destroy all nuclear facilities and capabilities and then stop the war. And that's where he's at now. We want to hope the ceasefire can hold. We also would love for Iran to stop trying to kill people, especially Israelis.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
We are back, and Jennifer Say is our guest, CEO of XXXY Athletics, also an author, filmmaker, outstanding business person, and executive, and retired national champion gymnast. Jennifer, great to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Are you surprised, number one, that this was even an issue? If I told you this was going to be an issue, trans men and women's sports, 10 years ago, what would you have said to me?
Yeah, I would have said you were nuts.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have believed it. And in fact, I remember having conversations with Nancy Hogshead, who's an Olympic swimmer, Olympic gold medalist from 1984 in like 2017. And she was already on this. And I was like, I don't know.
It's not a big deal.
I don't think it's going to be a huge deal. I get that it's not fair, but it just keeps accelerating. Even since Trump's executive order in February, it's accelerated in blue states. I think we're going to get to the point where in blue states, boys win all the track and field gold medals. That's what we're getting close to.
And could just take a backtrack a little. What does it mean to you? You're a highly successful athlete. Give everybody an idea of your athletic background.
Yeah, I had a pretty unusual childhood. I was a gymnast in the 70s and 80s, seven-time national team member, 1986 national champion. So, you know, competed at the highest levels of the sport, world championships, all of that.
Gymnastics?
Gymnastics, sorry. But no, regular. The four events, beam, vault, bars, and floor. I was an early whistleblower 20 years later about the abuse in the sport, which is a separate story. I was the very first whistleblower about the emotional, physical, and sexual abuse in the sport. So I'm kind of used to saying true but inconvenient things. But what I always tell people is an athlete of that level, you lose a lot. You lose more than you win. I mean, honestly, we don't all win all the time, except Simone. She wins all the time.
Right.
She went 10 years without losing a competition Simone that she entered.
Yeah.
I mean, can you think of another athlete that's done that?
No.
It's not possible.
Yeah.
And you get really good at it, and you build resilience, and you get up when you fall down, and you get up when you lose. But I couldn't accept a fight that wasn't fair. I mean, when I was competing, the Eastern Bloc athletes were using steroids. That was a big deal.
Right.
And we were tested before every competition.
I still remember the Sports Illustrated column with these East German women
yep.
with backs
necks.
Like, and necks and like these perfect Vs and acne from all the
of
steroids.
Course.
Yeah.
Yeah, on the back. Yeah. 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 And so, you know, that would have been difficult, hard to accept. If you don't feel like you have a fair fight in the competition, you want to give up. Why bother? And that's my fear with all of this is all of the gains for women and girls in sports. You know, I think 1,000 times more girls compete in high school sports than they did in 1972 when Title IX passed. There's so many benefits that come with that. If you know it's not fair, if you don't have a fair shot of making the team, possibly winning, you're going to give up and you're not going to do it.
Why bother?
Why bother? So I really see it as an existential threat to women's sports.
So remember, Title IX came into play, and the controversy was, if you're going to have men's sports, you got to have just as many women as men, and it was hard to reconfigure, still is, because football has so many people, and women
right.
don't play football, but they're solving that, too, because I think women are going into flag, and I think that could help balance things out. But having said that, that was the debate. I remember doing stories, I used to do all sports, with the Women's Sports Foundation over in Eisenhower Park.
Yeah.
And we used to go over there and we used to talk about the balance and women getting the same opportunities. And then we beat that debate and it becomes, okay, I get it now. Let's have equal opportunity and let's try to get the pros balanced down. The women's national soccer team, I was there with 101,000 at the Rose Bowl in 99.
Yeah.
So I could truly appreciate it. And all of a sudden, women in sports didn't matter anymore. Now we're talking about trans men. How dare you challenge a gender-confused person who wants to go beat women in their sport. I thought, wait a second, didn't we have this argument 30 years ago?
Yeah, I would argue the minute a male breaches the boundary of women's sports, it's not women's sports anymore. I mean, the women's category is basically open now.
Right.
Males who think they're women compete in women's. Women who think they're men compete in women's. Everybody competes in women's.
Right.
Only men compete in men's. And so, I mean, essentially, women's sports is already done for if we don't fix this. And let's be clear, the more boys that enter, the more boys will win. When boys compete in girls' sports, they win. They do.
I know. I mean, can you imagine playing soccer, field hockey? We've already seen it in field hockey.
Right? The girl got her teeth knocked out.
Yeah.
By a boy. In volleyball, there have been, you know, Peyton McNabb with a traumatic brain injury from being spiked in the face with a ball. But the fact isn't, this is what their side uses. They say, well, they don't always win, so that means it's fair. No, it doesn't. They still have male advantage. They are still bigger, faster, stronger. Just because they were really crappy male athletes and don't win in women's doesn't mean they don't have unfair advantage. Every male that takes steroids doesn't win the Tour de France. Only Lance Armstrong did. He still had unfair advantage. Every man that took performance-enhancing drugs.
The blood doping. So if you take an elite athlete and you cheat, you know, they just become even better.
It's still cheating.
Yeah, no one's saying that you're average and become the best ever. That doesn't happen
either. No, but you get better than you would have been with unfair advantage.
So, Jennifer, just how do you handle this argument? So I had Jason Crow here, a special forces congressman, Democrat. And I just said, well, the one thing we agree on, right, you don't have trans men and women in sports. And he goes, well, that's a fake issue. It almost never happens. And that's an issue that Donald Trump made up in order to win an election. and that seems to be the Democratic go-to, and you're a former Democrat, is that a spin you can accept?
No, it's false. That's just a line they use. I don't care how many times you say it. It's still false. This year alone, over, I think it's about 100 high school male track and field athletes have won. They've been on the podium in women's track and field in high school. That means they're going to get college scholarships in all likelihood if they're winning state competitions.
Right.
And I'll get to the NCAA in a second. So they are stealing team bursts. They're robbing girls of the opportunity to stand atop the podium and celebrate their hard work and their win 100 times this year already. In track and field alone, that's one sport. So that's a lie that it's not happening. And the thing is with the folks that claim that, that say it's a lie.
Really,
the minute you point it out, they go, well, it's a good thing. It's a triumph for civil rights. So they're all over the place. And then they go to, well, what do you want? You want genital checks, which is not what would happen. It's a simple cheek swab. One time, it's done. It's less invasive than the drug testing that I endured at every single competition. We had to pee in a cup with someone watching to make sure we weren't taking performance-enhancing drugs. It's less invasive than getting weighed in publicly for wrestling or boxing or all the things. So they go from one argument to the next. It's ridiculous. It's accelerating, unfortunately, since the executive order was signed because the blue states are leaning in. So no, he's wrong. He's incorrect.
So when Gavin Newsom says, you know, it does seem unfair, he doesn't do anything about it. In California, he's getting away as if he's enlightened. He's done nothing.
Well, not only is he not doing anything, he's now working against us. He's suing the federal government to continue to allow athletes like A.B. Hernandez, a boy who won two state track and field championships in two events. He's suing the federal government to continue to allow that to happen. So he's full of it. He says one thing. He's trying to appear moderate. He doesn't want to take a stand and risk angering right. the far left. In his state and nationally, but he tries to play both sides. But you got to take a stand here. Have some moral courage and a backbone. Stand up for girls. Why are this is the part that bugs me the most, upsets me the most. We are telling these young girls that they don't matter, that their opportunities don't matter. And every time a young girl stands up and says, what about us? She's vilified as a bigot. And so
still I feel like you're getting the momentum back here or you're getting it for the first time.
We're getting some momentum. But I'll tell you, I mean, I talk to almost every girl that stands up and what they deal with is pretty brutal. We work with a woman. She's not a high school athlete. She's older. She ran the Boston Marathon in like 2 hours and 45 minutes. Really, really fast. She took a stand because Boston allowed males to run in the women's category this year. Her team
felt female that day.
Yeah, exactly. They also have a non-binary category, which guess who wins? Men. Duh. Yeah. Every time. She got kicked off her team. Her running club kicked her off. They told her, don't wear your jersey to run with our team, a team she's been on for 10 years. Lost friends. She was stalked and harassed on her running app so people would know where she was on the field to threaten her and yell at her and throw things at her. So that's a pretty tough situation.
Oh my God.
For someone that really – I mean, I deal with it all the time. Riley deals with it all the time. But when you're new to it, it's pretty brutal.
But do you remember when Riley Gaines was forced into – in San Francisco, I think it was.
Yep.
Was forced into that classroom. Security couldn't get her out. She locked herself where she was forced to stay in there. Now she's – I feel like she's treated more heroically than she was back then, right?
She absolutely is. I mean, look at what happened with Simone Biles. You know, Simone attacked her on X. And did not expect, I think, the clapback she got. I think Simone lives in a world where everybody agrees with her and everybody tells her she's great. And that everything
she's a lefty celebrity world.
Yeah, and everything she says is great. And she's made this sort of offhand comment. She thought she'd get claps and likes. And she got a lot of blowback from women on the left and the right because we support Riley. And 80% of Americans agree that women's sports are for women only. But here's what I'll just tell you, and this is an illustration, I think, of how far we still have to go. Not a single currently competing professional or elite level, Olympic level athlete has spoken out.
Crazy.
So we have a ways.
That you're 100% right about that. And I think we're going to have a huge problem with the Olympics. When they come to Los Angeles with the Olympics, are these men going to try to compete in boxing and other things?
Well, the IOC is pathetic and they have a new president, the IOC, a woman named Christy Coventry. She has said in the past that she is for protecting women's sports. She has yet to do anything. The IOC could wave a wand and make it right tomorrow. They could make it right tomorrow.
How would
they
you
could
do
say,
that? How do you make it right? Like, what you do say you judge it on?
You say birth, only birth XX. Only you must be XX to compete in the women's category. Men's can be open. Anyone can compete in men's. We're going to do sex testing like we did back in 1999. We ended it with a cheek swab or spit in a cup. Spit in a cup. It's easy. One time. Then you don't have to do it more than once. You don't have to do it like weigh-ins all the time. You don't have drug testing you have to do all the time. One-time test. But the IOC has not done that yet, and they've sort of batted it to the individual governing body. So World Boxing has, which is what was so fraught in the last Olympics, there's a new governing body for boxing. It's called World Boxing, I believe. They have set a new rule to say you must be XX to compete in women's, and we will sex test.
Well, yeah, I guess we're going to see what happens there. So your apparel, this is your business acumen, mixing with your athleticism.
That's right.
So XXXY, men's and women's.
Binary. That's it. There's XX, there's XY. That's the truth. Yes, there are chromosomal abnormalities. They are still either male or female.
Right, and there's athletic wear.
It's like athletic wear.
You're wearing, for people that are not watching the stream, you're wearing a sweatsuit, right? Like, it's like
wearing
a tennis outfit.
So let me tell you, this is a special item. So just yesterday, in honor of Title IX, we released what's called a collab in the fashion world with Riley Gaines, our first ever collab. So this jacket, a velour 70s inspired track jacket, velour, is part of the Riley Gaines collection, which is live now. Very limited edition.
That's impressive. Now, what is your apparel background?
I worked at Levi's for 23 years. Before that, I worked at The Gap for 3 years. 30 plus years as an executive. Well, 20 plus as an executive.
Marketing,
product, e-commerce, lots of things. Mostly marketing. I was a chief marketing officer at Levi's for 8 years, but I was the brand president for 2 overall of product.
Wow. So you have that background, you have this mission, and you merged them both.
I did. And I was part of bringing Levi's back from the brink of bankruptcy in 2011 and taking the company public in 2019 with the IPO. And I feel like my skill is to create content and brands that intersect with culture and move public opinion. I just felt like there's an opportunity here. Not a single big brand is standing up for women's sports. Not one.
So you told me, too. I saw how we just mentioned Simone Biles got all this blowback. But you also said that you believe every major brand, if she came out and said, Riley Gaines, you're a hero. I agree with you 100%. Men should play in men's sports. Women should play in women's sports. You believe she would have lost all of her endorsements. Even though she got the blowback for saying the opposite.
Well, here, look, I'll speak to her. One of her biggest endorsements, it might be her biggest, is a brand called Athleta. So it's an athletic apparel company owned by The Gap. It's in San Francisco. I'll just leave it there. They live in a bubble. I worked there. They were a mile away from Levi's. I know the people that work there. They would have been horrified at the half of the criticism, you know, at the people who would have said you're a bigot, and they would have let her go and ended her contract.
How could a female athlete, successful female athlete, ever say it's fine with me? Do you know anyone, a successful active female athlete that actually believes it's okay?
Well, I mean,
trans man in women's sports.
Well, a lot are saying it. I mean, Megan Rapinoe is saying it. I don't
know
her. Yeah, just retired, but I think she would have said it even if she was still competing. I don't understand it, but this is why the language matters. They've got this dumb language in their head that trans women are women. Trans women are men. They have male bodies.
Yeah.
But that insidious language has infiltrated the culture, and we have to take it back. They are not women. They are men. And so they think it's bigotry. I mean, it's so misguided and stupid. And, you know, I can't even believe we have to have this
I can't even either. But Jennifer Say making the most of it. She is the CEO of XXXY Athletics, author, filmmaker. When we come back, Jennifer, I'd like to get your take on the economy from the business executive perspective, too. And we'll talk more about this. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back. We've got a few more minutes. Just talk about the economy for a second. And no, it's not going to be a big, beautiful bill. We got a very successful executive, the CEO of XY Athletics, author, filmmaker, business executive, retired national champion gymnast. Also, Jennifer Say worked at Levi's for a while. And prior to that, you worked for?
Gap. But the Levi's Gap. For 2.5 decades.
So I was talking to somebody that has an apparel company that was making their shirts in Vietnam. And they called panicked. Can you give me an idea what Trump wants to do with Vietnam? What about these trade deals? Have you felt it as you are manufacturing now your own sportswear line?
Yeah, look, it's certainly something we need to pay attention to. We make all of our cotton goods in Peru. We've been okay so far. We do make some performance wear in Vietnam, and we're looking to make more and more in the United States, which is the goal, really. Now, the challenge in terms of production in the United States is we don't have the skills and capability here. You can't find sewing machine operators. We don't have the fabric innovation. We don't have the factory. So it's not a solve overnight, but I'm all for bringing more manufacturing to the United States and doing far less in China. We don't produce anything in China because you can't monitor the factories. You can't enter. You don't know the working conditions. So that's off the table for me.
So tell me about the consumer. Does the consumer feel free to spend?
Do you feel
to spend more for 2025? Do you feel as though they feel good about the economy, and when they do, they'll spend?
When they feel optimistic, they'll spend. I think that their key indicators are positive despite the gloom and doom from the mainstream media.
Right.
The S&P, I think, is about to hit an all-time high. Unemployment is low. People feel optimistic, and they do spend money. I know for my company, even if we see goods increase in price a bit, we'll just take a margin hit. We're going to keep our prices the
and
same
that's pretty
and ride
much what
it
the
out.
Country's been doing. With the tariffs, if the money comes in and it's harder to, it costs a little bit more, they're not making the consumer pay at this point.
Right. And brands out of China there's all these fast fashion brands out of China that are selling you $3 t-shirts. You don't want to know the human rights violations. So they're, you know, everybody's screaming and yelling, even the left-wing press, about how the prices for these brands has gone up, like Temu is one of the brands. Who cares? I don't want people buying that garbage.
That should be the pushback. Are you happy that slaves are making it, that children are doing it, and that the Uyghurs are forced to do it?
Forced labor, exactly.
Well, I'll tell you what, it was great to meet you, Jennifer, in person. Been seeing you on television a lot. Jennifer Say, CEO of XXXY Athletics. Where do we go if we want to order your stuff?
You go to thetruthfits.com.
The Truth Fits. I love it. Jennifer Say, thanks so much, and thank all of you for listening. Keep it here. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.